Wood County Prevention Coalition podcast, dedicated to bringing educational information to prevent substance abuse and help individuals achieve a healthy well-being.
Hello, my name is Tina Bradley, and you're listening to the Wood County Prevention Coalition podcast. I am the coordinator for the Drug-Free Communities Grant, as well as Prevention Coalition in Wood County, Ohio. Today's subject is The Addictaholic Deconstructed, featuring Dr. Nicole T. Labor. For those who don't know us yet, I'll read our mission. We are a coalition of compassionate community members working together to coordinate high-quality programs for the prevention of youth substance abuse in Wood County. Our vision is helping youth be drug-free, responsible, and productive citizens. Our tagline is Uniting for a Drug-Free Wood County since 2004. Let's take a few moments before we get started to do further introductions.
Hello, everybody. I'm Kyle Clark, Prevention Education Director here at the Wood County Educational Service Center.
Hi, Angie Patchen, the Program Manager for the Prevention Education Programs here.
And with us is Dr. Nicole Labor. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you with us here today, Dr. Labor. Can you share with us a bit about yourself, please?
Well, I'm not sure what you want to know, but I am a board-certified physician, board-certified in family medicine and addiction medicine. I work out of Wayne County and Summit County here in Ohio. As the medical director of multiple treatment facilities for substance use disorder, I think I also work in Erie, Pennsylvania, and Medina County, and a bunch of places, really.
So a whole regional area.
Yeah, Northeast Ohio really is kind of my stomping ground. That's where I work for the most part. I'm a mom. I'm married. I have lots and lots of animals, and I wrote a pretty kick-ass book that everybody should read if they're dealing with someone that has a substance use disorder, and generally, you know, an all-around sort of badass. That's who I am. I myself have been in recovery from addiction for almost 18 years now, so when I approach the topic, I'm approaching it from a multitude of different angles, really all of them, as a family member, a recovering addict, and a professional.
Well, we are honored to have you conduct two sessions tonight at the Wood County Educational Service Center. Can you please highlight for us what it means to say the addictaholic deconstructed?
Sure. I don't think anybody's ever asked me, actually, where the title came from. But so when I was actually in treatment 18 years ago, I think I was at a meeting, a 12-step meeting or a support group meeting, where someone introduced themselves as an addictaholic, sort of all encompassing all the substances and this just general idea that it doesn't matter what the drug is, it's the disease process. And so I always liked that, and I sort of adopted the addictaholic title for myself. And then I started presenting in Addiction 101 lecture back in, I want to say, 2012, to healthcare professionals and communities, and it was the same presentation. So it became really evident that people didn't understand addiction at all from a disease perspective, and so that became a really popular talk. And to me, all I had done was taken this disease process and literally deconstructed it. Like, I broke it down in a way that I felt was understandable for really any audience. And so when I was writing the book, the idea was, honestly, I'm kind of sick of having to, like, go to 50 million speaking engagements all the time. It would be nice if I could get this information out to a wider audience. And so when I was writing the book and I had to come up with a title, I also think I was watching a lot of the Food Network at the time, and they always deconstruct dishes. And so I feel like that word came to me in that way. But yeah, that's kind of what it means. Just I break down the disease as much as I can.
I'm kind of jumping ahead to answer the next question that hasn't been asked yet, but I had the privilege of listening to Dr. Labor speak at the Addiction Studies Institute that was virtual, so I shouldn't say at, but during that those series of presentations, and immediately, I mean, I've been in this field for a little while, mostly mental health for a while, and then some of the prevention stuff for about 8 years, and I was texting another colleague during the presentation going, this is the best thing I've ever heard. It started to make sense finally. And that's why I went back to Kyle and said, we've got to get her here. I want to bring her here to our community and have, you know, a presentation on this and get this word out to folks. Because I think, like I said, even having been to a lot of different presentations, you hear that disease model and it's like, okay, what's that really mean? You know, if you're in health, maybe that makes more sense, but for preventionists and such, to really understand it is helpful. What are some of the biggest misconceptions you think people have about this whole topic?
I mean, certainly when we think about the stigma of addiction, I mean, where is that rooted from? And that's just a complete lack of understanding. I think that there's still a lot of disconnect between the idea of a brain disease and choice. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, when I try to explain the brain and the process, you know, I explain there is choice, a choice component. I mean, we all have free will and we can choose what we do. But to sort of just throw a blanket statement across all people who have a problem, like a substance use problem, and say they've all chosen this life, you know, and therefore they're bad people, or they, you know, their value, their moral compass is off, or their value system is corrupt. And that's just not true. And in fact, I could argue, probably based on the way that the brain works, that people with substance use disorder, for the most part, actually have a stronger moral compass, because the guilt and shame that they have associated with the things they do tends to re-traumatize themselves over and over whenever they use. So I think that's a big misconception. You know, it's odd because you know what you know, right? Mm-hmm. You only know what you know, and you forget what other people don't know and that they don't know what you know. So for me, living in this world, you know, of addiction, I mean, that's what I do all day. I forget that there is a whole world out there of people that aren't dealing with it every day. So I think that for some people, there's still this misunderstanding about pain medication, any medication really that has addictive potential, about, you know, when is it safe, when is it not safe to use, who really becomes addicted, this idea of willpower and that people can just stop when they want, that's a big misconception. Mm-hmm. Because again, if you don't understand how your brain works and what willpower really is, then you're never going to really grasp that concept. I think people don't necessarily understand the nature of treatment. What are we doing in treatment? Medication-assisted treatment gets literally, that's like on two ends of the spectrum, in my opinion. You have the people who are completely against it because they don't understand how it's beneficial. They think it's, you know, replacing one drug with another. Mm-hmm. It's a crutch. It's not right. Helpful. And then you have the people on the other end that are like, medication for everyone, all the time, no matter what, right? So I think we have two ends of that spectrum. That are both wrong, mm-hmm. in my opinion. The treatment aspects in terms of, you know, like what are we doing? What are the standards of care for treatment? Not really understanding what support groups are. The 12-step community is something that most treatment programs still really strongly use and utilize and refer people to. And I think that the general public has very little understanding of what that actually is.
Right.
And so they tend to build up these very negative thoughts about it. And there's really nothing negative about it. I mean, mm-hmm. really has some super beneficial aspects. So, I think those. And like, this idea that, you know, you're going to one and done, you're going to get fixed from the illness and then you're done forever versus chronic illness. I mean, I think people don't get that either.
Well, I know, you know, this all came about because Angie had the privilege of hearing you on a recent webinar or a seminar that was virtual. There's another piece of the whole thing, mm-hmm. though, that kind of made it happen, and that was the funding mechanism. Kyle, you want to speak to that?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. The opportunity for us to bring Dr. Labor here was a direct result of our opiate task force, which mm-hmm. is funded by the Alcohol, Drug Addiction, Mental Health Services Board here. And so we took the idea to the task force board meeting and talked about the pros and cons, and they said, yeah, let's do this. Let's fund it. Let's bring Dr. Labor in. So we really want to thank the Adamus Board and the Addiction Task Force for supporting this. We were eager to jump in as a prevention coalition and as our prevention work in general, because we also see that whole connection. The prevention part is going to, in the long haul, I think, help the treatment end if we're successful to help combat mm-hmm. addiction in the future. But I want to jump back in a little bit, Dr. Labor, with the whole idea of the brain science and the idea of a disease, because I think a huge portion of our community still is living with a stigma that this is a choice, this is bad. They really don't understand. So could you spend a few minutes talking a little more about the science and the brain and the, you know, when I finally realized we're talking similar to a cancer patient or a diabetes patient, they can't control all, they have some control, but they don't have total control over that disease and or those diseases. And so what's any difference? And I think that's what we've got to tear down.
Yes, so I'm, okay. Well, spoiler alert for anybody that's gonna, you know, watch a video or read a book. But so there's two components, I think, that we have to talk about. One, the genetic component. Obviously, you have to have a gene for a disease process to occur. So there has to be some genetic mutation, or you have to have a gene present in order for you to develop any kind of disease, right? So, and then that gene has to be triggered or turned on. So you can have a gene for some disease process, but if it's never turned on or triggered, then you're not necessarily gonna experience that. So like just, and again, this I tend to really super simplify this. So if there happens to be like a geneticist or microbiologist listening, like, sorry, but, yeah, it's super simple. But let's say you have a gene for lung cancer, but you never pick up smoking, you never work in a chemical factory, you're never around smokers. Chances are you're not going to activate that gene, so you're not going to develop lung cancer, even though you have a gene for it or a mutation for it. Whereas if you do have a gene or a mutation for lung cancer and you never smoke and never work, or you don't have the gene for it, so you have no mutation, no gene, and you do smoke 10 packs of cigarettes a day and work in a chemical factory, you're not going to develop lung cancer. You'll smell bad, you'll have COPD, nobody will want to be your friend, you'll be yellow from nicotine, but you will not get lung cancer because you just don't have the gene process. So addiction's the same way. You have to have a gene for it. And 60% of all people have at least one gene for it. Most people have more than one. And genes can be triggered by anything, right? So realistically, you could have a gene for addiction that is triggered by, let's just say, one use of alcohol, right? And other than certain religious sects, I don't know a single person who, or adult person, who has not had, made the choice to have at least one alcoholic beverage in their lifetime. But nobody knows what their genetic profile is. You don't know if you have an aunt 10 generations back that had the gene for addiction and therefore you have it. And even if you knew that you had it, you don't know what's going to trigger that gene for you. And so, you know, that first drink of alcohol could potentially trigger someone's addiction. So, you know, I think that's the first piece, is understanding that pretty much everyone makes the choice to use a substance at some point in their life, in their adult life. The next piece would be obviously what happens once that gene is turned on, you know, and there are changes that occur in the brain that are outside the control of the individual, just like the development of a brain tumor, right? So people get type 2 diabetes, people get cancer, A, because they have genetics for it, and B, because they made certain choices in their life about whether they were going to consume certain types of foods or chemicals or come in contact with toxic and stressful environments or how they're going to deal with their stress. I mean, those are all things that contribute to the development of these disease processes. But the same is true for addiction, right? So for most people, there needs to be some sort of trauma maybe, and then the exposure to a substance. And so, you know, once that happens and the gene is triggered, these changes happen in the brain, which render the individual unable to just stop using it, right? So there is a difference between people who are using substances, even if they're using a lot of them, and those that actually have developed substance use disorder. So they're two different groups of people. Now, one can turn into the other one, but that one can't turn back, right? Once the cucumber's the pickle, you can't make it a cucumber again, or whatever that saying is. So yeah, essentially, you know, if you're using substances on a regular basis and are able to just stop on your own, you don't have the disease. Your brain chemistry looks essentially normal. But if you take someone who's struggling with using substances and they're trying to stop and they're running into problems and they can't seem to get it right and everybody's going, why don't you just stop? Your brother stopped, your uncle stopped, the neighbor down the road stopped. And they're going, I want to stop, I just can't. If we look at their brain, if we scan their brain, if we look at the what it looks like, it's substantially different than the person who doesn't have addiction. So, you know, in that regard, there's an actual process neurologically that's happening to these people that renders them more defenseless against this than somebody without that disease process, if that makes sense.
Yeah, thank you.
Makes perfect sense, mm-hmm. Definitely. And I'm assuming that when we say addiction, we mean any form, because it does come in many forms.
Yeah, so I am really, it's funny because people say, people talk a lot about words matter, and that's a big, you know, topic right now. They're, oh, words matter, and be careful what you say. And there's even a whole sect of people who don't feel like you should call yourself an addict if you identify as a recovering addict, because that language is like condescending to yourself. And I mean, as a recovering addict, I don't care what you think. I'm gonna call myself what I want, you know. But there is this whole movement about language, and I think that people use the word addiction way too freely. I do think that they use it in circumstances that are inappropriate, and that makes it really difficult for people like myself when I'm trying to explain addiction to sort of tease out what the difference is. So when we're talking about substances, obviously we have chemical dependency or substance addiction. So any substance that releases a high level of reward chemical in the brain falls into that category. So you have your illicit drugs, your prescription drugs, the alcohol, things that people use and we know they abuse and become addicted to. And those all can kind of, they cross-react, right? So generally, if you're addicted to one, you're addicted to all of them, even if you've never used them, because the brain can't tell the difference. But then you have your process addictions, right, which are your behavioral addictions, and those are not the same. They are the same in terms of what's happening in the brain, but there's no crossover there. So those are very gene-specific. So you would have a gene for specifically for gambling addiction or sex addiction, video game addiction, or whatever. I mean, it's not what they're genetically called, but essentially that it's that blast that you get from those activities, and those are very individualized. So, but those certainly count and need to be treated in almost the same way, and identified in the same way. And those people, same thing, they just can't just stop. And a lot of times what we see is obviously substitution. So people say, oh, I used to use, you know, whatever, some substance every day for 10 years, and I haven't used it until I'm sober from, I hear that a lot, I'm sober from methamphetamine, but you're drinking right now. Like, you're literally drinking alcohol, right? Yeah, but I haven't had methamphetamine in 10 years. Okay, well, your brain doesn't know the difference, right? But that's another, I guess that would have fallen under the misconceptions question. That's a huge misconception. People think that there's a difference. But they'll substitute a behavior, you know, the exercise, workaholism, even social media can fall into that category. But it's not a guarantee that everyone that does those activities is going to have a problem with them. It really becomes about identifying what those symptoms are at the end.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, along those lines, I think you've talked about the addictaholic part. Like, do we have an opiate problem, or do we have an alcohol problem, or we have an addiction problem.
Yeah, I talk about that a lot in the beginning of the lecture series that I do. It's not. There isn't. It's that whack-a-mole game where you bop one down and the next one pops up. Like, we keep fixating on specific drugs as they become popular. And if you look at the trends over time, I mean, starting in the 1800s with the over-prescribing of morphine to women because they had opinions and we don't like that, so we had to put the kibosh on it. So everybody got morphine. But then they all got essentially addicted, and there was some negative outcomes. And then in the 1800s, Bayer Pharmaceutical created prescription-grade heroin, and that was introduced to more men because there was businessmen and men who needed to, like, focus, and they were very stressed. And, you know, opiates are great drugs, and so it had all this all these indications, but same thing, you run into that problem of addiction. So they took it off the market. We saw illicit heroin in the 60s. We saw cocaine in the 80s. We saw methamphetamine in the early 2000s. We saw bath salts, designer drugs in 2010, 11. And then we saw the rise of the opiates, you know, again. And then now we're kind of looking at meth, a different meth, but it's a meth issue right now. So yeah, I always tell people, like, we need to stop focusing on the specific drug and focus, or on the mole that we're bopping down, and just unplug the machine, right? Like, focus on the disease of addiction and get that under control, because it's the same problem, you know. And I think that when we are really fixated on the opiate problem, and it is a problem, I mean, don't get me wrong, I mean, people dying is concerning, especially young people, you know, before they even have a chance to figure anything out. But even at the peak of the opioid epidemic, there were still more people dying from alcohol-related deaths than opiates. And that's always been the case. Alcohol has always been number one, but yet we don't have alcohol task forces and conferences and all kinds of things about every year, right? We just focused on the opiates because that was rising quickly and affecting populations that perhaps we cared about, I guess, to say it, to put it bluntly, the populations we cared about. So, yeah, so I think that we have this tendency to focus on the wrong thing instead of just the overall disease process, which is, you know, I don't think we're never going to treat the disease to extinction. We're just not. So we have to look at the overall process and how to prevent that instead of just specific drugs. I know now we focused on opiates. We put everybody wanted medication, because for some reason in this country, in Western medicine, if you can't treat it with a pill, it's not really a disease, right? If the treatment is behavioral, it must not really be a disease. And so even though there are medications that are very helpful in addiction, they're specific moles, you know, they're specific for specific drugs. A lot of it is behavioral, and we need to focus on how to manage that, because when opiates were on the rise and we started putting everyone on medication for opioid use disorder, what happened? They all started using meth because we didn't bother to treat the underlying addiction problem. We just simply said, oh, here, take this so you don't overdose on opiates, and good luck. And that was kind of it. And we just left them out to swim, and we didn't teach any of them how to actually swim. So now they're all using meth and marijuana and alcohol, and can't understand why they keep, you know, relapsing back on opiates. So yeah, it's very difficult to get people to understand and grasp that concept, because you have a conscious and a subconscious part of the brain working, and yeah, people struggle.
Okay. So I know you mentioned your book. Where might someone purchase the book, get more information about it?
So I think that you can go on Amazon. It's on Amazon. And pretty much any retail website where you would buy books. You can BarnesandNoble.com, Walmart.com, Target.com. You can buy it on any of those sites. You can come to my office directly and buy it from me. You can come to any of my presentations, and I usually have books. I have a website. I'm not super great at keeping up on it. I probably shouldn't admit that, but it's www.theaddictsdoc.com. So theaddictsdoc. So theaddictsdoc.com. And I think there's a link on there to buy the book, and there might be some description. But yeah, there's a lot of reviews on Amazon. I think there's over 200 reviews on Amazon. So you could kind of get a picture of whether people like it or not by going there.
And I know you mentioned at presentations, books can be purchased too. Do you have any upcoming presentations that want to make the listening audience aware of?
Other than today.
Other than our two today, yes.
So I'm not really the person to ask, to tell you the truth. My assistant, God bless her, she is 100% responsible for my schedule, and I just get a text message like the day before reminding me I have to be somewhere. So I have no idea.
But
if
they
I'm
should
speaking.
Go check your website.
Yeah, I mean, really, I should keep up my website. But it, the email, her, the email too, would be theatticstock@gmail.com. And if somebody wanted to know if I was speaking, they could email that that question, and we
Perfect.
Would be able to
or
answer
wanted
it.
Wanted you to come and speak to an audience.
Sure. Really. Yeah, that's the best way to do that. Social media. I'm on social media. I'm on Facebook and Instagram and LinkedIn. A lot of times I'll post things on those sites if I'm speaking and I know I'm speaking. Yeah.
Any final thoughts from anyone today? You know what? I have a question. I really do.
Okay.
So I know you were saying, you know, the overuse of the word addiction. Can you maybe address, you know, let's say alcohol, because it is a part of many people's lives. And how does someone know if it's a healthy use of alcohol versus they truly have an addiction?
Okay. So I usually tell people if they're asking the question, there's a couple of things you can do. Well, first of all, if you have a loved one that has said to you, and they're not like in some sort of religion or something where they don't think you should drink at all. If a loved one says to you, hey, I'm a little worried about how much you drink or even how much of any substance you use, and your response is to become defensive and justify that use versus questioning why they're questioning you, I think it warrants some looking into, right? Because and I always say if a loved one says to me, hey, I'm worried about all the cookies you eat, you know, I'm going to say, whoa, wow. I mean, I really like cookies, but okay. I mean, is there a reason something happened that makes you concerned? And if they point out to me why they're concerned, I'm going to go, you know what? I will probably look at knocking out my cookie consumption, right? But if you're like, oh, you don't understand, I have a stressful life and I do this and this and I'm an adult and it helps me relax and you have all these excuses, you know, you've just placed the use of a substance over the care and concern from a loved one. Like, you are risking that relationship to continue to use a substance. So I don't know how that's not really at least on the border of a problem. So I usually tell people to pick a day on the calendar, 30 days from whatever day it is that they want to see if they have a problem, and try to abstain from all substances for that period of time. And try not to overdo, like, the caffeine and the sugar and, all you know, the substitutes. But just say, hey, I'm not going to drink or smoke pot or, you know, do any substance for 30 days from today. And if in that 30-day period they find themselves making excuse, oh, I forgot my cousin's wedding was, you know, this next week, or, oh, I forgot the boys were coming over, we're going to watch the game, I just have a couple. If there's an excuse to use any substance, they might want to consider getting an assessment from a professional to see, like, am I falling into the category where this could be problematic? If you breeze through 30 days without even thinking about using, I'm going to tell you, first of all, you'll probably be like, shoot, I should probably keep not drinking because I have so much energy and I feel better and I've accomplished more and I'm motivated. But if they breeze through it and they have no issues, then, you know, okay, we'll go back to your social drinking or whatever. You've at least shown you've been able to do it without difficulty. It's not saying it won't be a problem in the future, but that's an experiment that people can do for themselves over and over and over. And that may help them at least step into the door a little bit sooner.
Mm-hmm. That's great advice. Mm-hmm. Great advice anyone could use. Any other thoughts from anyone?
My only other thought was back to, you know, you talking about, I don't want to say the wrong term, people in addiction or and the guilt and shame that they feel, not to be a downer right at the end of our, of our podcast, but can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I don't know if people realize or if they just think that you don't care, you know, that you're just trying to get drugs and you don't care about anybody else, like, and that's not true.
Well, sure. So trauma trauma, right? So when we talk about trauma, we talk about chronic and severe stress. When people have, well, and not again, not everyone, there's always a genetic piece at the beginning of the whole, there's always that disclaimer, right? There's a genetic piece. But for most people, when you have chronic and severe stress, or AKA trauma, some of the changes that occur in the brain are similar to those in addiction. So oftentimes, if trauma precedes addiction, the trauma actually primes the brain. It sets it up for the addiction. But on the flip side, if the addiction comes first, often the addiction itself causes trauma, right? Because you're you wind up in situations that can be very dangerous or traumatic or whatever, and then that sort of feeds back into that negative feedback loop. But one of the things we know about the human condition is that if you have a core value system, so you know right from wrong and you have a certain set of beliefs and values, we are set up to adhere to that. And when we violate that, we get a sense of guilt. We get a sense of shame because we know we've done something that violated our own core value. And so that actually trips the same process in the brain as trauma, right? So feeling shameful about something that we've done is actually a self-inflicted trauma. And so that in and of itself makes it worse. So if I'm lying to my family in order to use these drugs, and I know that lying and manipulating is wrong, but I'm doing it because in the moment I'm craving and my midbrain's active and all those things that are happening in addiction, it's justified, it's impulse control issue, it's instantaneous. So I'm using, but I'm lying and I'm manipulating. Now I've used, I've satiated that craving, but now I'm left with this sense of I violated my own core values. I lied to my family, I hurt somebody I love, that's not the right thing to do. Now I feel terrible about it. But because I have addiction, and the other part of the conscious part of my brain is wired to deal with stress by using something, the only way to deal with my guilt and shame is to go out and use something to make it go away. So now I have to use again in order to dampen how bad I feel about using. And then that creates a new sense of guilt and shame. And it just becomes this horrible, vicious, negative feedback loop. And so that's why I say we know that people with addiction don't have a moral issue, because they wouldn't, there would be no perpetuation of that cycle. They would not feel bad or guilty about using. They would just continue to do what they wanted without the guilt or shame, but then they wouldn't need to keep using to hide that guilt and shame. So there would be periods of time where they'd be able to just kind of stop and be fine. So I would argue even, you know, and this is probably not, this is just my own opinion, but I would argue that somebody that was like a sociopath, like that had no, you know, moral compass, I would argue that that person could even become addicted, truly. Because I don't know without sort of that guilt and shame associated with continued use that someone could really develop a use problem.
Okay. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Perfect sense. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Labor, for joining us. And we're getting ready here at 2 today to start the first presentation, and I am looking so forward to that. Next time we'll be back to discuss yet another prevention-related topic. In the meantime, check us out online at www.wcprevention.org. You can also link into our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram pages there as well. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This podcast is intended for educational purposes only. Those views expressed on the podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the Wood County Educational Service Center or the Wood County Prevention Coalition.